You're listening to the Why Europe podcast by Greater Europe Mission, where we explore how God is moving on the continent of Europe and how you can be a part of it. Visit gemission.org to learn how you can join us in prayer, partner financially, or potentially serve in any of the locations that we discuss. My name is Nathan, and I passionately challenge, recruit, and develop Christ followers to join us in pursuing this mission and vision of GEM. Just like Tom Guffey did over 40 years ago when he began his journey serving with us in France at Camp of the Peaks, a camp that is near and dear to Greater Europe Mission. We talk about his journey getting there, learning French, French culture, obeying God, and if you listen close enough, you can hear the beautiful sounds of Camp of the Peaks. So enjoy this episode.
I started with the equivalent with 10-2 45 years ago. So then I played around with that. I did 11 summers coming and going before we came as a family. And we've been here 30 years as a family.
Wow. Okay. So 45 years ago, 11 summers. Why Europe? Why did you choose Camp of the Peaks? Why did you choose France?
I wish there was some big, huge missionary story back there, but I came to Europe because I didn't want to get stuck in my little hometown where I was at, because I thought that was a disaster, and so it was not a good situation at all. I figured I was going to get trapped in that lifestyle and everything that goes with it if I didn't get out, so I decided I was going to go backpack around Europe somewhere, and bought my little orange aluminum frame backpack and was ready to go, and I had a camp counselor come through that asked me if I want to do something important. And so he sent me all this information about stuff. He said, you could spend a lot of time doing good things over there. So Your Corps was one of those, which is now 10-2. It was one of those options. And it was the smartest option for me because I had building experience and they were looking for builders. And so I just said, I can do that. And so I came and was pretty amazed at kind of what was going on here. And I saw that there was a lot to do. So it was a job security if I kept coming back. And made some good friends right there at that first summer who continued to come back, and they too went full-time in this ministry. So they were instrumental in kind of dragging me along with them. And there was one of those summers I was sitting out here on some of the steps that we've now rebuilt, and I felt the Lord very clearly tell me, this is more than just you having fun, Tom. This is, I got something more. And so that was all I needed to stick around. I haven't heard anything that strong yet about to leave, and so we're still here.
Yeah, great. Great. So where are you originally from, Tom?
I come from Riverton, Wyoming. You ever hear of Wyoming?
Yeah,
so yeah. Stayed up there in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, but I've never heard of Riverton. Yeah, never heard of Riverton.
Yeah, that's it. Riverton. No, nobody would.
Not much to do there, huh?
Well, it's there's not much good to do there. You can get in a lot of trouble, but it's a good place. It was a good place. It's country.
Were there mountains where you're from?
We kind of grew up at the foothills of the Rockies.
Nice.
So that's kind of what I was interested in, mountains. I mean, it was part of my childhood, and it's I love just being out in them. So that this is one of the perks on what I'm doing here.
Exactly, because you've got an incredible, mountain face right behind you, and you get to look up and see that every day. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I don't take that for granted. I get up every day and look at it and just thank the Lord that, he gave me a purpose and meaning here.
Amen. So what would you say is Camp of the Peaks? Could you give us a little bit of history of Camp de Cime?
Yeah, Camp of the Peaks, and the short version is that about 56 years ago, God decided to show up in this little old village and start changing lives. And he's been showing up for the last 56 years here. The heroes are the first missionaries who walked onto the property, and they did a camp down at a little house that is now a neighbor's house. And in doing that, they did that for a couple of summers with the youth camp, and then they found this place while they were doing that. And so they went, got information about it, and they bought it for $5,000 in 1969, and they started redoing it right away.
Wow.
And even before they had any facilities at all, I mean, God was coming here meeting people. They had just had, none of the facilities were theirs for the first 2 years. And, but God showed up and they just thought, well, this is a great tool. And it really is in France where, the thing about the camp to me, short end of it is, you can't, I can talk to people about anything when they come to camp. A Frenchman on vacation is not a Frenchman anywhere else. A Frenchman on vacation, he throws his shirt off and he, you know, he runs around in shorts and flip flops. And you can ask him any question you want because he's on vacation and you're far from his normal setting. Mm-hmm. Whereas if he's back home, he puts on his tie, he's a shutter closer. That means at night he closes all his shutters, and that's kind of the way his heart is. He closes his heart and he sticks to what he knows. But I found that here at camp, you can make a lot of advances in a short amount of time just because of this French vacation mentality. And the camp has just been taking advantage of that for years.
Mm-hmm. And so throughout the year, what is the camp doing? So obviously it's a camp, so you're hosting people. So what kind of camps are you hosting?
Well, yeah, the French get a lot of vacations. So about every 6 weeks, they get 2 weeks of vacation. So they have a lot of vacation. And so and they stagger those zones. And so whenever they do a vacation period, we have about 6 weeks where we can offer camps. And so we'll do everything from organize our own to rent out to associations that are like-minded. When we do our own camps, we do family camps, some English camps in the summertime for kids, young adults, and teens. Yeah. And we do a couple of ski camps in the winter. And then we're just starting a handicap camp this April. So that's the next camp we have coming up, is a handicap camp for kids. It's the first time we're going to do this with a coworker that has some experience in that area. So that's what we're starting, something new. I think that's going to probably be a very significant camp because there's a lot of need here in this country for those kinds of things.
Yeah, totally. Totally. So I just want to rewind a little bit. Like 45 years ago, 11 summers. What were those 11 summers like? What were you doing each summer? Was it purely construction, or I mean, because that's a long time. I mean, 11 years. I was 18 11 years ago, and if I did that for 11, that would just have a significant impact on my life. And so, what was each summer like? What did it look like? I'm sure it looked different, but was it just construction, or what else did you do at camp?
There was enough construction to keep us busy, but it wasn't as much as I probably wouldn't have kept my interest for very long. But there was two guys when I first came in 79, so it was 10 years after the camp was purchased. I came and they were like on their second or third year of EuroCorps, and they were going to spend the whole year kind of as an intern. And one of those guys became the maintenance man, the other guy came the program guy. And so for very soon, 79, even in 80, 81, the program guy started doing his mountain guide degree. And he had to go out and he had to log mountain climbs. In order to become a guide, high mountain guide. And so he needed somebody to go with him. And so I wasn't afraid of the mountains back then because I grew up in the Rockies. We'd climbed all over the Rockies fishing, you know, with my dad. Yeah. And so he took me out, and so we started climbing stuff. And so that part was that wound up being part of the program here at camp, where we would take people out, you know, in the mountains and take them to the top of things and across glaciers. And so there was that part of that. When the camps were here, I was involved in the program. And then when they left, there was always something to do. And especially when we began in 82, we started breaking ground on a new building that doubled the capacity of camp, and that's our main building that you and 10 tours know so well. And so that took 14 years because it was off with volunteer help. So a big job security thing there is I knew, and so they got me working on the rocks, and so there's a lot of rock in this building, and that was what I would do every summer. I'd come here and lay rocks and run teams, and I didn't see the time go by at all. And it was it was something, you know, I think you talk about, I think a guy needs meaning and purpose. I think everybody needs a meaning and a purpose. And I think when you find that little place where you can do what you love to do, and at the same time, you know, you're finding meaning and purpose, I think that's it's a gift from God, because I'm not sure everybody has that. And that was a gift from God to me, so it was great.
That's right. That's right. And so as you were going back and forth, what was the conversation like with your parents? going back and forth from the States to America? And like, what would you do, you know, throughout the year doing, like working a job and such?
Well, I have a mother that prayed. She was divorced by the time I was two and my little brother was just born. And she had three boys. I was the middle guy. And mm-hmm. she prayed from day one for us. And so it didn't surprise her when we came to faith at a young age. And it didn't surprise her when I was 12 years old. Some guy came through at our Baptist church and made the Baptist call. And I walked down and to give my life to whatever that meant. And she knew right then. She, in a sense, she had my funeral right then saying, he's gone. And knowing that I would someday be somewhere besides Riverton, Wyoming. And so she had done that. And so it was easier for her when I was getting on the plane at 21, she says, you know, I always knew you'd do this. And I said, do what? And she goes, from that day you walked down that aisle, I knew that you'd be somewhere else. And so that was easy for me to keep doing that. So the family end of it was Tom's out there doing what he was supposed to do. And then the other end of it was when I'm back and forth, I was able to finish schooling. When I'm bouncing back and forth, you come here in the summer, you finish up your schooling. So I went through graduate studies in fine arts, got an MFA, and it was I couldn't really figure out what that was all about because God didn't ever send me. He never sent me to seminary or to Bible school. I took some Bible classes, but I couldn't figure out if I'm a missionary. I figured he was going to call me to that, but he kept calling me to the arts. And now I understand it because an artist, you know, an artist is a starving guy that can't get another job in America. But here in France, the artist is the esteemed theology, you know, person.
Yeah.
Theology in the sense of self as God. But it's really – I have a platform here that I would not have in the States just by being an artist. And we've used that to our advantage here at camp. So, it all makes sense as you're looking back on it. But I think to answer your question, it was easier for my family to give me up because they realized I was doing exactly what I was supposed to be doing. And my wife, when I married and dated her, the first thing I said was, France is a piece of my life. I'm not sure how it's going to fit in. But, if you're willing to kind of walk through this adventure with me, we'll see where it leads. And sure enough, she was a traveler, you know, was easy for her to go, easy for her to leave things behind in the States and come here. So that's another blessing.
Great. Hey, man, that's so cool. So, so I just have so many questions to follow up on. There's just this, all of this is really good stuff. So one question about the art, and then I'd start with though, you know, going for 11 summers, what was the language like? Were you learning, like actively learning French while you were there, but then when you were back in the States, and at what point did you, you know, feel like you were proficient enough to keep up with people?
I'll tell you when I get there. But growing up, I just started learning French by listening to what the kids were saying. Mm-hmm. And so my first French words were slangs and, you know, Christian cuss words and the real cuss words. That's the stuff that the kids will teach you.
Yeah, exactly.
It didn't mean anything to me. You know, they were just sounds. When we started bouncing forth, back and forth doing school, as soon as I could, went to a school that had French. Then I began to take French. And that was helpful because it gave me a bit of a base. But really what helped me to speak French was just being here with those campers, those young people that didn't care what you spoke. They wanted to talk to Americans, and they tried to teach you all their fun stuff. So that helped me actually in my accent because I learned words before I ever read or wrote anything. And so when I went to language school, that was a revelation as to all these words that I knew, what they looked like. And of course, French drops the last letter off of everything. So that was an interesting paradigm to watch at. But I think you think you're good to go. You can start being intelligent at about 10 years in, unfortunately. I mean, some people say it's quicker. You can communicate. You can get your word across. But French doesn't become yours, I think, until about 10 years in.
Wow. Why is that, do you think? Is it because is it because of how the French people respond to your French, or like, is it a confidence thing? I'm curious, because I've heard different things that people say about French and other languages as well.
No, I think it's because you have to be in the culture. I think it was the culture. Living here, speaking French changes everything because your experiences are all in French. And once your experiences mm-hmm. start being in French, when you tell them, they come out in French, and you're having to think of English words to translate instead of what, always the other way you're thinking. You're translating from French to English in your mind. When you're telling stories and they're in French, you're struggling to think, okay, what was the English word for that? You know, yeah. if I'm telling my family a story. So that's what I mean by it really becomes yours. I think being in the country and growing up and having cultural experiences is what really helps you with the language. Again, you can speak and communicate, but it doesn't flow from your inner, you know, your inner self, I don't think, until at least 10 years in. That's the way I see it anyway. But I'm still learning French right now. I mean, I try to learn new things, and because I think that's a lifelong process, learning the second language anyway.
Totally. That's really wise. 10 years. I mean, really, anything worth doing or anything worth having is not easy. Anything worth living for is not easy. So I'm sure after language school, after seeing words, like maybe your confidence went up, or what was it like doing language school? I'm curious if you were speaking it already and then you had to go into all the formalities of language school.
Well, I was speaking, you have to remember, I'm speaking slang, and the French love they got the two forms. You got the formal form and the informal form. And mm-hmm. so I went to language school, and the Germans would come up to me. We had a lot of Germans in language school that were going to Africa after language school. And mm-hmm. one of them was saying, listen, you speak better than I do, but you're not near as well good as I am at school, you know. So he was very frustrated, just very honestly mm-hmm. saying, you know, you're a terrible student. Why do you speak better than I do? And I told him that I just grew up, you know, starting from 20 years old, I was listening to it every summer and then keeping in touch with my friends. And so language school was interesting because every time they would ask for a synonym for a word, I would give it, and the teacher would say, nope, wrong. Don't ever use that again. That's too familiar, because they're wanting you to learn the high French. And then after you learn the high French, then you can use the low French. But I was learning the high French, but I was using the low French all the time here, because you don't use the high French with your campers, or we're in a different setting. We're in a vacation setting. So you're using that low French. So anyway, it was interesting, and it got to be funny that every time I said something, I'd raise my hand and say, this probably isn't going to work, but here you go. And they would just laugh. After a while, you know, it's like, yeah, no, don't use that. And because the kids taught me stuff, and the kids teach me what, they don't teach you the correct way to speak. They teach you how the people speak.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Which, to me, that is the correct way. The way that the people speak is the correct way.
It's the way that people live, for sure. But it is nice to be able to go into an office somewhere and to speak to the people that are, you know, the government, any kind of officials that you're dealing with, and to be able to speak the high French. Yeah, that's very, very important.
Yeah, so true. So true. And you mentioned earlier that you were an artist. And so I'd love for you to, you know, unpack that a little bit. What kind of art do you do? What kind of art does Camp of the Peaks offer and represent?
I started, the first thing I did after I left the camp in 79, summer of 79, was I signed up for college, you know. And so the first stuff was, in Wyoming, nobody goes to, at that point in time, nobody went to college unless you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. So everybody just went to work, which is what I did right out of high school, is went to work in construction. Then when I got out of here, I thought, you know, I probably won't like to go to college and see what that's all about. So, and then I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I was always good at art in high school, you know, and that I enjoyed that. So I said, well, I'll kind of focus a little bit on that. And that just never went away. And so I just kept focusing on that. And I found that the experiences that I were living here were being expressed in there. And especially when I went to Texas. So I'm living here on all these mountains in the summer and having these great experiences. And I go to Flat, Texas. And all that stuff came out. So my graduate work was all, I concentrated in ceramics. So my graduate work was these big rock-like formations and things that I would make out of clay and fire. And so I just a whole room full of these pillar-ish kind of looking things that I did that spoke about all those times of climbing in the mountains. And so it was very complimentary, at least at the time. I had a lot of things in me that I lived here that I was expressing over there. Art school is another world. It's much like the French world in that hardly anybody believes. They're all atheists, at least they're. But I don't find them to be practicing atheists. I find them to be, you know, atheists, but because they can't think of anything else to call it. But most of them are mad at God, and that's what I found in art school is most everyone is mad at God. All the teachers are mad at God. And I just told them, a couple of them, I just said, well, I think you believe in God. And they said, no, I don't. And I just simply said, yeah, well, how can you possibly be mad at somebody who doesn't exist? Because they were mad. And so they would make them think a little bit. So I was a little older when I went to graduate school, so that was helpful. I wasn't just straight out of high school and then, you know, the normal age. So I was 29, I think, or 30 when I finished. So it was, gave me a little better art world's great, but there's some very, very lost people.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I've heard that Camp of the Peaks offers pottery and certain opportunities for that. So what does that look like if somebody were to come?
Part of what I started doing early on was setting up a studio. So we did some drawing first because one of the things I really got into was looking at somebody's drawing and then seeing their personality out of that drawing. And then I found clay, and then we started doing that with clay. So they would do these little things, and then we would just kind of – I started studying what stuff meant. And so that was – I didn't have to go into the psychiatry of it. But the psychology of it was interesting, just to kind of see some tendencies, because the minute you pull some of these tendencies out of someone's artwork and say, I see this in here – they're really quite shocked that much comes out in their artwork. And so we did some drawings, did some clay stuff. That was kind of the first beginnings of our workshops. And then eventually I started packing some wheels over here because I had some old wheels somebody gave me. So I packed them in the backpack and would bring them over and set them up with the motor here. So we had about three or four potter's wheels, and we started doing that and working with clay. And that became like a workshop that we offered. And so then we started offering fine art workshops with people that had competency in painting and theater and eventually video making when that came into being, the thing to do. And so we would get qualified people in to give those workshops, because you do art, it is expression of self. It's right out there. Your work is in front of people. It's much easier for somebody to turn toward a piece of work and say, this is me suffering. And this is my childhood here, when you're pointing at something rather than just talking and saying, yeah, I had a rough childhood and I suffer with this. When they're pointing at their artwork, they're very open about who they are and what they've just expressed on that piece of paper. And that's what we found is the art is a quick way to somebody's heart and to their soul. And so it was, it's been a great tool.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, just for and helping kids, just helping them, because they're willing to express their hurts and their suffering and all that, and then you can help them from there.
That's right. Yeah, that's really good, because I say all the time that music is a universal language. I may not speak your language, but if I play music, then we can relate to that in some way. We can either not like it together, or we can either like it together, or you can dislike it and I can like it, vice versa. And art, that's so true, because people may not be able to have a conversation, but many, many times they can express themselves through some sort of art, through some sort of creativity, and tell their story that way.
Mm-hmm. It's a common language. We all speak different languages, but it's amazing to me, just like you said, music traverses all those languages and all those cultures. And it changes a little bit culture to culture, as does the art. But the heart and the soul of that stuff is there. God made something in all of us that connects with somebody else, no matter the language. That's a really neat thing.
Yeah, man. So, Tom, through 40 years of your obedience to, be planted in France and just working on the ground there, what is some of the fruit or some of the stories that you've seen that have just kind of stood out to you, if any, that you have that you'd like to share? I'd love to hear one or a couple of just some amazing things that God has done through Camp of the Peaks and through your ministry.
Trying to make me cry, Nathan? Yeah, so the real gift of working in this place is the French are very faithful to something that they start, especially to their leisure time. And so we're working with families that I know, the fourth generation of family are crawling around in our nurseries right now.
Wow.
And so first time I came to camp, I met this this family that had a young boy, 14, and he came to work with us, Frank, and he came to work with us on the buildings because we needed help. So he just came early one summer. And Frank grew up. He came to camp. He did some of this mountain stuff that we were doing, and it really touched him, and he gave his heart to Christ. And then he disappeared. Didn't see much of him. That was back in the time we don't have telephones, you just have letters, and, you know, I wasn't a good letter writer. Lost track of Frank, and then he came back enough years later to where he had four kids, married and had four kids. And one of those little boys was, you know, actually all those kids came back to several camps, and they all gave their life to the Lord. Some of them were here, some of them were, you know, outside of this, but we were a big part. Frank told me, he said, we were trying to figure out something for our kids. We take them to church, but it was just that missing link between what school and the society's telling them and what we were telling them. He said, we just thought they needed to come to camp. And sure enough, by them bringing their kids to camp, those kids got saved, and they're all doing some really cool things right now. Their second son came here, and he, from about 14 years old on, he said, I want to work at camp. I want to be at camp. I want to do that. And so he fell in love with the little girl here at camp, and she, you know, they eventually got married, and he became my son-in-law. So this is Rhea, his husband, Flo, is what they call him, Flo. And they signed up. They've been here a year with us, and they're full-time missionaries with Greater Europe Mission here working. And his big heart is to do exactly what happened to him, to just get with those families that are just looking for that little extra something, help with their kids, church families if necessary, but even the non-believers, and to just give them that tool to help them raise their family. And, you know, I could sit here and talk with people that are working. Well, Sebastian Bont, who's working up in England and Scotland now, part of Greater Europe Mission. He has a great testimony about the camp and about this place, and I'll let him tell you sometime in a podcast. And then over and over and over again, one of the biggest missionary guys in France is about 40 some odd years old. He came to the camp while he was smoking a cigarette down at the fountain just below. He snuck out with some couple of girls, and they were down there. And he said, while we were down there, we were talking. None of us believed in God. He said, and we're talking, and all of a sudden, I realized it was like his third year here. He said, I realized this is it. This is reality. This is truth. And he came to faith. He became this. He went to Bible school. He led another center across the valley, and then he's. Probably the missions reference in France right now for sending people out on missions. I could go on and on if you want stories. I tried to write them down once, and I just thought, it's going to take a little longer time. Maybe I'll wait till retirement to do that.
Wow. Yeah, I'm sure it'd be a book full. And I would, and when you do, Tom, I will be in line because I want a copy of all the things that God has done through your ministry.
He's been so good. The thing I go back to what I said, God decided to show up here and meet people. That's so freeing, because that takes me out of the equation. I come and I keep the building up. You know, you get a good program in, you just have stuff for people. But he comes and meets people. It takes all the pressure off of anybody doing anything or that we did anything fantastic. We just keep the place open. God comes. It's humbling. And it's as long as he keeps doing that, I'll keep, I'll faithful to be here.
Yeah. It's incredible what God can do on the other side of our obedience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I haven't always been obedient, but I've been stubborn. So it's hard for me to quit something that, I heard the call to come here, and I have never heard that call that strong to do anything else yet.
Yeah.
Maybe I will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great, man. So what are your favorite things about the place that you live and where you've done ministry? Maybe some things about French culture that you love, or favorite foods, things like that?
I think it's the friendships. I mean, the French only have two or three good friends that they would call their friends. American would have 100 good friends.
Right.
They would say that. The French really have stable I don't know. They treat their friendships right, because they say, I can't have a ton of friends because I can't be a friend to all those people. So
Right.
I think that's probably it, is that the French are just stubborn and ornery, and they're everything you can imagine, but they have just the biggest hearts. And once you become friends with them, you are really family. And so that's probably the biggest thing that my takeaway from France. I mean, if you've been to France, you know how they can be just cynical and all that stuff. But I just really, I enjoy that conversation, and I enjoy, you know, getting to know them and building friends here in France. Yeah, everything else is peripheral. It's great food. I get to live in the mountains. It's probably the biggest thing was I got to raise my kids here, and they got to see something different. And they were in this, you know, they were kind of barefoot and free running around here. So that was a real special thing for them and for us to be able to do that here in this place. I think France is a place that, well, we all know it's culturally, they're a place that has changed the world in many, many ways. They changed the art world. They changed a lot of things that happened. And even now, a lot of technology that's coming out is French born. And so it's a country where you can realize, you can just feel kind of the influence that they have on the rest of the world. And it's just, for me, it's a privilege to be here and try to have an influence on them.
Yeah, I love that. I have a heart for the French culture as well. I've tried learning the language, but it sounds to me like I've got about 7 or 8 more years before I get confident
I don't want to discourage you, because I think it's great that people learn French. But you're talking about feeling comfortable and mastering that language to where it comes out, you know, it's just part of you. That's what I'm talking about, the 10-year mark.
Absolutely.
But, you know, you can come and help us some more, and I'll help you on that French.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, my problem is I could say what I want, but I can't say like off the cuff. Like I have to think about it. So I get that's what you're saying. But when people speak back to me, for me to comprehend, because I've learned through listening and reading books and stuff like that. But man, when someone just talks to me and spits it out, it's so fast, and I have to really think about it for maybe, it has to compute, you know, like it has to buffer for maybe 3 or 4 seconds before I respond. So I won't give up.
And one of the things that really encouraged me is that there's people in English I don't understand. They say stuff fast, and
exactly,
you know, when I come to that realization, I just thought it was, okay, I don't understand this guy because I don't, it's my French. But what I realized is I turned to a French guy and he goes, what did he say? So that's a real freeing factor, is to realize there's people in English I don't understand either. So it's not always just me not understanding.
True. Yeah. So what are some of your needs for Camp of the Peaks? What would you like to see God do or provide moving forward in your ministry?
Well, one of the big things that people always ask us now, because I'm on that 65 range, and they ask us, what happens? What are you going to do? Where are you going? And I just tell them, you know, I don't think we're going anywhere. I think we're going to stay put. I said, but I am going to free up a little bit of my time, because there's some projects that I've been wanting to do, you know, for a long time. And if the Lord's in them, then I'll be able to do that. And there's about 3 different things that I've always wanted to do here. One of them was this handicap element. I wanted to do handicapped kids ever since we had to turn a kid away about 15 years ago because we were not adapted for him. So our location is up to speed now, and we have a personnel here at camp that's going to, like I said, just going to help us with this handicap element. That was something I wanted to start. So that's off and running, and by the Lord's grace, we'll be able to keep doing that. The other thing was missions. I want to have Condé Seam sending people out of here. We have missionary trips with kids or families, and we're taking them because Eastern Europe is just right across the way. And there's a lot of stuff going on that we could access fairly cheaply and fairly easily, and a lot of work to be done. So I'd like to lend this, that mission thing, get that out there. And then I'd like to get Seb Bonk back down here and get a whole discipleship element, because I think we're uniquely set to do certain types of discipleship. And there's some stuff going in France. There's some things that we send kids to and that are good things. But there's that, somebody came to me recently and said, this is a French guy, and he said, there's nothing bilingual out there. So I'm wondering if you guys could do something bilingual. And I said, well, if you're going to come and teach, this is a pastor, a big pastor here in France. And I said, you'll come and teach? Yeah, we'll do some discipleship stuff here. And then I just want, I'd like to get that. I'm not sure even how that's going to look, but I've always wanted to, I knew that we had a role in discipleship, but it hasn't been formalized in a way that I think we could reach out and just do more of it. So those three elements are things that I'd like to be able to concentrate on, which means I give some of the brick and mortar stuff away. But the other side of the coin is we have some really good young people that just showed up.
Amen.
Six people, three new couples. And it's one of those things that these kids are all way beyond, you know, talent wise, they're just way down the line from what I was when I started. And so they've got a real jump on the story. Well, my daughter and son-in-law are one of those, you know, they don't have to learn the language. They don't have to learn the culture. They don't have to learn the camp. They have it, and they're starting at that. They're starting there. So what they can do is really going to, I think they can really do some neat things. So that gives me people to delegate responsibility to. And eventually I just want to, I don't know if you met Dan, but Dan, our Australian, maybe you didn't, but he's our Australian coworker, French wife. I just told him the other day, I said, Dan, you need, I'm going to turn it over to you. And I just need you to start to lead. You know, you got it. You're more talented than, you know, six men that I know. You know, he could do so much work. He just doesn't want that last final responsibility. Well, he's going to get it, and he knows it now. So, and I see him, we're turning that corner. And we're headed in that direction. And it's been a real blessing to watch that happen. And this team's going to be a good team. And my goal is to just help them succeed as best I can, whatever that means. But I do have some projects that I'd like to see started here.
Yeah, totally. Well, Tom, thanks so much for your time. I just feel led, and I sense the Spirit prompted me to pray for Condesim, to pray for your ministry. And after I pray, could you pray for the person listening, and I guess just for the future efforts of your ministry and for anybody who's going to step foot on the camp, you know, in the future? That would be fantastic. So,
sure do that.
Yeah, I'd love to close our time in prayer. Perfect. Dear Father, Lord, I just thank you for Tom and his obedience, and I thank you that you've sent him and he said yes, and Lord, that you've made him stubborn enough to stay, and Lord, that you speak to him and you've raised up a great family and new laborers to work this ground. We pray for more laborers, God, and Father God, I just pray that you bless the efforts of Condesim. And I just pray that many, many, many more come to know Christ because of the work that's done there in France. And we pray this in Jesus' name.
Seigneur, merci pour ta grâce, merci pour ta fidélité. Seigneur, personne ne sait à quel point tu travailles dans le cœur d'homme, mais tu le sais. Et merci, Seigneur, pour le privilège de travailler de tes côtés. Et ici, au Condesim, on voit ta main. Année après année, dessinant après dessinant. Seigneur, tu travailles dans le cœur des hommes. Et je te remercie. Merci pour le Condesim, cet endroit où tu viens rencontrer les gens. Tu sauves les uns et tu encourages les autres. Merci pour l'équipe sur place, cette nouvelle équipe qui se renouvelle. Seigneur, bénis-les et qu'on puisse t'en gloire dans tout ce qu'on fait. Merci Seigneur parce que tu es toujours là, tu nous aimes autant et Seigneur tu nous guides dans nos pas. Continuez Seigneur de venir rencontrer les gens sur place et qu'on puisse te rendre la gloire. Seigneur, trouve-nous fidèles quand tu reviens. En ton nom je prie. Amen.
What can God do on the other side of your obedience? What can God do when you say yes? When you say, God, whatever you want to do with my life. I'll never forget when I prayed the prayer, God, make my desires your desires. If you pray that prayer and God says Europe, then we'd love to talk with you about it. Go to gemission.org. You can join us weekly for prayer, give to Tom's ministry, or serve with us. We invite you to serve with us. So visit gemission.org to learn more. Until next time.